Hello, everyone. Welcome to the first episode of the new EDPS podcast series, Debating Ethics. This first episode is dedicated to discussing the relationship between ethics and the law and the role that both can play in shaping the digital future we want to live in. We will have the honor of talking with five brilliant contributors, Julia Poles, Peter Scharr, Sandra Watcher, Johan Antokol, and Pernille Tramberg. I am Giovanni Buttarelli, European Data Protection Supervisor, and I had the privilege to host this first conversation together with my esteemed deputy Wojciech Wiaworowski. Wojciech will take over in a minute and guide us through the discussion. Let me start by saying a few words about our motivation to host this podcast series. Why podcasts? We have been witnessing how public discourse is increasingly shaped by online interaction in various forms, and we are eager to play our part in this by bringing together different stakeholders and perspectives in this innovative format. Listening is much more accessible and immediate than reading. We want that our podcast are a forum of open, free, and public debate. We believe they can contribute to shaping the discourse on the new ethical questions arising in this changing ecosystem. We have started debating ethics at the International Conference of Data Protection and Privacy Commissioners in October last year in Brussels, which my institution, the European Data Protection Supervisor, had the honor to host. We dedicated the conference to discussing the meaning of human dignity, autonomy, and respect in the digital age. 2018 was not only the year of the GDPR, General Data Protection Regulation, but also a year in which we saw an increased interest coming from many sides in debating new ethical questions around emerging technology. Why is this? Profiling, tracking, scoring, and questions of surveillance, political micro-targeting and advertising and its impact on democracy, algorithmic discrimination, the attention economy and digital addiction, new biometric technologies and massive data breaches, many were the headlines that kept us in suspense. The question that emerged for us in policymaking and enforcement is, of course, how to react to these challenges in a responsible way and timely manner. Human rights instruments and various sets of legislation can help us address aspects of them. From our new powerful European Union data protection regime to regulation that safeguards consumer protection, but also competition law, labor law, and more. Yet legislation is by nature reactive. It is usually late while society has already paid the price. We all know that. This is why we are here today, yet again, to debate ethics. Now the term ethics can be understood in different ways. At the European Data Protection Supervisor, we promote a broad understanding of ethics. We look at it as a continuous and vital process of societal deliberation about what is right and what is wrong, never ending, taking place and shaped on many levels and in many forms, some more official and conscious, some unconscious. We now see how more and more and also very disparate efforts emerge towards defining what is right and wrong in the digital world. This raises questions on the very processes behind this making of ethics. Who defines what is right and wrong? How and for whom? More companies, but also governmental institutions, are issuing ethics guidelines, charter of principles. How should we assess this trend? Is it a move into the right direction, or is it a maneuver of deception? Are values being abused as marketing buzzwords or as covers? Or is the ethics debate getting so big right because there is such a strong need for it? These are some of the questions with which I would like to open this first debating ethics conversation. So now let us get straight into it. Wojciech, over to you.
Welcome again. My name is Wojciech Wiewiórowski. I'm the assistant supervisor in DPS, which means a deputy supervisor, deputy of Giovanni Buttarelli. And together with Giovanni Buttarelli from 2014, we are playing the role of the supervisors of the EU institutions, bodies and agencies, but at the same time taking part in the legislative process as the advisors of the European Union legislators. For this initial discussion, we invited five wonderful guests, and really the people who gave a lot to the discussion so far. I also don't want to hide the fact that inviting the speakers, we also took some of them who have controversial opinions on ethics and the involvement of the regulatory authorities in discussion like that. So today we will hear Juliette Pauls, who is an associate professor of law at the University of Western Australia, and she is a privacy journalist, but she also has a lot of experience in the academic field in the other parts of the world, starting from the UK and going to the USA. We have Peter Scharr with us. Peter Scharr is a chairman of the European Academy for Freedom of Information and Data Protection, the former Federal Commissioner for Data Protection and Freedom of Information in Germany, and one of the, I may say, fathers of this discussion about the new approaches to privacy and at the same time dissemination of information around the world. Pernille Tranberg, I don't need to present. Pernille is well known for her work, not only in the think tank that she is right now dealing with, the Data Ethics EU, but also with the books about privacy as a competitive advantage on the market. And we will definitely touch these points that were raised in her publications so far during the discussion. We have Sandra Wachter with us, research fellow in data ethics, artificial intelligence, robotics, and internet regulation at the Oxford Internet Institute, and John Antokol, co-manager of the US data protection law firm Park Legal. But Joanne is in the field for quite a long time, for 7 years, playing the role of the privacy head in Novartis, having a lot of experience in the field of e-health, health itself, and the pharmaceutical industry. So, welcome again, and let's start with the first question to the speaker. We'll start with Peter Scharr. Peter, may I start with you? Knowing that sometimes you try to play the role of the devil's advocate, and you are also quite critical about the soft ethics, which is potentially undermining the hard law. Could you explain us, do you think that this is really the danger? Well, I always say that when the lawyers don't know what to say, they say, oh, that's an ethical issue. This is one of the buzzwords to be used. But at the same time, we decided to jump into these waters of ethics. What is your point of view on that?
Well, very welcome to all participants and to the audience. It's a very difficult question, but my impression is that we are dealing as data protection community with a very limited scope of questions relating only to personal data. I say only. This does not mean that personal data isn't important, but personal data, or the dealing with personal data, is only one very important aspect of the whole picture. And the whole picture we learn today about is that data processing is one of the building blocks of the information society and of our daily lives. And the decisions that are based on data processing are invisible in many cases for those who are affected. And even the criteria are not visible for them. And therefore, we need a new debate on what are the ethical grounds, what are the limitations, what should be the safeguards, even beyond data protection. Data protection is dealing with lawful data processing, but now we are in a world where data processing is used for essential decision makings in our world.
Okay, so do you think that the data protection authorities should take part in this discussion, but should not be the leaders, or should influence the whole debate, no matter if it's on the privacy issues or generally on the ethical issues of the digital world?
Well, of course, data protection authorities are an essential part of this debate. And whether they, if they are become the leaders, depends on the role they play and on their input and their and on their feeling what should be their role and the acceptance by others. So, but the first answer is clear: yes, data protection authorities have to participate in this debate. But there are also other very important players, technologists at first, but also philosophers and other professions who have to take part. It's a debate really covering the whole society and all professions, or almost all professions, medicines. Legal experts, and so on.
Okay, I think we all can agree that this discussion has to be multidisciplinary, and we will definitely come back to that later in the discussion. But I would like to ask Sandra, who has a lot of experience in teaching and discussing in the academic field on the internet, on the new technologies, on the role of the regulation, having the course on that on the Oxford University, but also being in contact with the other academic academic entities. You teach students about that. Do you think that these students, these young people, can also teach us, those who think that they know something about digital world? Could they do it with the daily experience that they have? Is what should be the main messages that we try to convey to the students? And at the same time, should we expect to learn from them? Well, I still have in my mind the experience with Max Schrems. Max Schrems, who as a student simply asked, are the things that he was taught in the university the real world? And me being at this time the National Data Protection Commissioner, I was somehow ashamed by him because he did the things that the regulators should do. He asked the questions to the court that probably the regulators should ask before him. And he did it as a student with his open mind. What can we pass to the young people on that, and what can we learn from them at the same time?
Yes, I very much agree with you. I think the experiences that I have with my students is that it's a very discursive process in the way that that I think is important, right? You are conveying a message to the students, but you really want to get their opinions back. It's not talking at them, it's providing them with information and inspire their thinking. And I think you put your finger on something that is critical, that very often students ask the right questions. They ask, they understand there is something underlying and they want to know more. They ask the why question. But why is it like that? Why is it regulated like that? Why is it not regulated like that? And why are we not doing anything about that? And that actually, if you have been working in that field, that why question is something that challenges your own thinking. So in an ideal setting, I think the teacher learns from the students and vice versa. And that's definitely the experiences that I have with my students. And I think one of the things that we try to do, at least in my course, because I focus on technology and regulation, is the question, what are the societal implications of emerging technologies in general? What are the benefits? What are the trade-offs? And if you think about the possible risk, how would you govern that? And again, that's something that I try to convey to them, and I explain to them what's currently being done, but I encourage them to think about how they would do it differently. And very often there are very creative and new ideas that I haven't thought about, others haven't thought about, and that has to do because they also, of course, are very bright, but they also come from very different backgrounds. So if you've been working in a specific area, it's very, very important. And I think it was just mentioned that you get very diverse views and very diverse concepts, because they force you to think about different things and widen the horizon. And I think one of the questions that we are dealing with has to do with how and when and under what circumstances should we regulate. And there's a very big debate currently going on whether we should use ethics or law to regulate certain things. And there are very different opinions on that. And I think that's a very important discussion to be had. My current feeling actually at the moment is that it's a very binary discussion. So there are very, the one camp is very much in favor of ethics, and that ethics should be in charge of mitigating those risks. And the other camp says, oh no, we need hard enforceable laws. There is no way around that. And I think the truth is probably somewhere in the middle, if that makes sense. I think we have to think about very creative ways, think about the possible risks. And if there are problematic things that we don't want to see in a society, then we need to think about effective regulatory mechanisms that increase accountability. And I think that's not going to be a binary discussion. I think that has to do, and it was also already mentioned, has to do with sectorial risks and the context in which those systems are being deployed, and then make the right decision in that right context, because otherwise we end up with an insufficient and not accountable framework.
Can we somehow generalize saying that the ethical dimension, ethical approach, I would say, ethical approach from the young people is different than the one that is present on the legislators level or regulatory level? Is it the huge difference in approach, or the young people are open, but they actually follow the same values and the same ethical approaches as the older generation, which is right now deciding how the things operate in the law, because not necessarily in the technology, because the new developments in the technology are often done by the young people.
Yeah, I think that they have definitely an advantage in terms of knowing what's going on. So they are very much in touch with the current technology, and they know a lot more about the current trends. And they are, you know, just starting off. So their mind is unencumbered and very open and creative. And so they come up with novel ideas, either to regulate it or to use technology for something that, you know, might not come as easy to you if you have been in the field for quite some time. So there is this novel creative element that is very, very helpful. I think in terms of, you know, ethics or standards, I think they are very, very aware of the potential risk, but they're also very excited about new technologies. So I think they bring the right mix to the discussion in terms of not being too binary, but actually understanding that there are benefits and trade-offs, and trying to find like a good middle ground and a creative solution to that. So I think those voices need to be heard. because it's our future generation.
So my question to Julia then, Julia, you have recently published together with Helen Nissenbaum the piece titled Seductive Diversion of Solving Bias in Artificial Intelligence. And you ask why so much attention in the debate is on digital, in the debate on digital ethics is centered on the issues of algorithmic discrimination. And you suppose that the discussion should be a little bit broader and to touch more fundamental questions. What are these fundamental questions that we need to raise before we start the discussion about the very technical subjects?
Thanks, Wojciech, and great to join you all. I just wanted to quickly pick up, and I'll connect this answer to what we've heard from Peter and Sandra, because I think that part of why we have this conversation about ethics needs to start from the premise that it's not because the law is negotiable. I think what Peter's saying, and I agree with, is that even perfect implementation of an imperfectly enforced law, like data protection law, still leaves gaps. And as Sandra's saying, a lot of those gaps are places where ethical discussions provide real opportunities. However, in the conversation about ethics, which the EDPS and other institutions have been part of, there's been a real narrowing, I think, of what that conversation could be. And it's narrowed in particular around a great interest in addressing computational bias and a fight for computational fairness. And this article that I published with Helen Nissenbaum, a real pioneer in the field of bias in computational systems, argued that while bias is an issue with these systems, it's inherent to systems that learn from data. When you drive a system essentially by learning from the past and then finding predictions based on that, you will inherently be perpetuating the biases and imperfections of the world that we live in and that we have inherited. So we say that there might be some, you know, it's useful to recognise that bias problem, but a unilateral focus on it as our ethical mandate really, I think, deprives us from looking at fundamental questions, as you pointed out. And these, I would point to two in particular. One is, it stops us talking about the fact that really there's this ongoing, I'll put it in strong terms, a data heist happening from individuals who generate data and companies in particular, and also governments that aggregate and hoard it. We have this spectacular situation that we as individuals have very limited rights in an ongoing way around that data, and yet it can be hoarded for all time at no cost with very little limits by corporate entities. So I think that data asymmetry and power asymmetry is really something that's an opportunity to address with ethics and is completely unaddressed by the bias debate. The second is, I think that fighting bias in technical terms is a response that's internal to the logic of automation. It doesn't allow for solutions that are outside automation. And I think we're rushing headlong into this world where we rely increasingly on automated systems that have many flaws that Sandra and others have really comprehensively documented, where we will not understand the systems, they will by default leave many people worse off. And I think that the fundamental question we need to ask is, where does our ethical framework come in to say, should we be building these systems? Who should build them? What should be required as a matter of proof before you deploy them as experiments on populations? And what is the appropriate role of machines?
As a follow-up to this problem of the logic of automation, does it then mean that we should first of all, deal with asking the ethical questions to those who are creating the solutions, or we should avoid the automation as the only way of dealing with the data?
Well, I think it's two-sided. I think part of what the problem with the computational bias discussion is, it cedes power to the people designing these systems, and it presumes that the only way that we can have ethical systems is to demand it of the designers of those systems. I think that's a very important aspect of it. But I think preliminary to that, there's no other domain of technology where we think it's appropriate to have a rule of, if you can build it, you You should. We have all sorts of regulation around technologies like cars and drugs and food. And I think that we're just in a really immature state in relation to automated systems, that we don't have the same sort of preventative mechanisms to require that before systems are deployed at scale, when they have dramatic consequences on people's lives and life chances, that they should demand some modicum of proof and that safety and so on is assured. So I think it's both sides. And I guess I know that you said at the beginning we've got some controversial perspectives here. I just think it's over working the notion of ethics to think that it can fill all of these gaps. I think it must act in concert with legal regulation, with strict controls on corporations, and I think also some legal reform. So to that issue I said about this spectacular asymmetry between individuals and companies, I think we've got real opportunities for reform around the law on data hoarding, for example, in unjust enrichment, in creative looking at intellectual property laws. Data is like other assets, an intangible asset that should have limitations on hoarding and use. And so I think they are real opportunities to redress some of the issues that we're looking at in addition to ethical guidance.
Okay, thank you. So now I will turn to Pernille, and I will ask two questions which are actually combined one with another. I really love the fact that you start to look at the position of the business as those who can use the privacy and protecting of the privacy as the competitive advantage. This is something which the data protection authorities often cite and often recall should be like that. But my question is it really true? Is it really true that the companies are using that for this purpose? And the second thing is connected with the fact that we have a little bit of demonization of the work of the business and the role of the business. I would like to cite Jérôme Lanier, who was one of our advisors at the previous stages of this discussion, who said that the right way to fix the problem is not so much to attack the companies, but to point to them that what they do is not so much in their own interest. So on one hand, we want to show that it's a competitive advantage for them, and on the other hand, we want to show them that they have a little bit bigger role in the society than just to create the money for themselves.
Hi, Pernille here. Well, I believe businesses have a responsibility as well as governments to have a good law and enforce the law, as well as individuals who have to take care of themselves. Businesses also have a responsibility. Nobody has, we don't have one part who is responsible. We have all of us. And just with businesses, it's the same with humans and governments. We are all different. There are lots of good businesses and there are lots of bad businesses. So you can't take businesses as a whole. And where I see most optimism, where I feel most optimistic about creating a data democracy, where individuals take control of their own data, that's actually within some private businesses. Because some of the very visionary ones are beginning to see this as a competitive advantage. Just like what happened with the whole green movement back in the 50s and 60s, we saw some visionary companies who took the first steps and started this movement, which is really big now, right? It's not all the masses being aware of buying organic and the climate changes and stuff, but it is a movement. And that's what I think we'll see with personal data as well.
Okay, and finally, my question to Joanne in this first round as the last question. I would like to touch the fact that we have more and more countries around the world who have the comprehensive data protection law. That's at the moment, it's 132 countries that are counted this way. But at the same time, one of the biggest markets and one of the most important markets for the developments, the American one, has sectoral laws, but no not the comprehensive full regulation on privacy, which is a choice that was so far followed by the American administration, and it seemed also to be followed by the American business. But there's more and more discussion on the development of the privacy law in the United States. At the same time, we had the Federal Trade Commissioner Noah Phillips, who during our conference said that there is a big risk of overregulation, and we may have a situation where we do not understand what we regulate. So the flexible standards can serve useful and adaptive tools as adaptive tools for these reasons. And my question comes a little bit to your experience, especially the one in the health sector and pharmaceutical sector, where on one hand we have in the United States the very strong legal act as HIPAA is, and in comparison with the solutions that exist in Europe, it might be found much more effective even in the data protection than the European equivalents in this sector. On the other hand, we have the pharmaceutical industry, which says a lot about the ethical approach to the work that they do, but which has enormous problems to set the code of conduct for years. They tried already three times to prepare it on the international level, and it actually failed because it's hard to find this kind of consensus. So is there something like a common ethics, at least in the sectors, and is there a possibility to do the things by self-regulation or co-regulation, or it should be regulated in the law?
Well, thank you for that interesting question. I agree with Commissioner Phillips as well in terms of his statements on the possibility for overregulation. And I think that codes of conduct can work in certain contexts, but not always, especially if they're not embraced by many individuals. In a specific sector, such as the pharmaceutical industry, it's a little easier, I use that word loosely, to arrive at a code of conduct. It's still very difficult, and many stakeholders involved and so forth, but a little bit easier than to arrive at codes of conduct that apply across all sectors. We have lots of stakeholders, as been mentioned, when it comes to privacy and personal data. We have individuals and businesses and regulators and politicians and so forth, technologists, experts. And so it's very, very difficult to embrace everything that all of those groups want in a code of conduct. And we've seen a number of groups put forth various codes recently in the U.S. There's been an absolute explosion of privacy bills on the federal and state level since introduction of the GDPR. And in some ways, it makes it more confusing because you have this flurry of different codes that are being presented on the federal level and by various stakeholders, also in response to the new California Consumer Privacy Act. And this makes it more confusing because you don't know which group's code is the right one, or if there is a right one. And with all the different versions that are floating around, sort of the message is diluted. And so I think that, you know, as you said, the U.S. has had a sector-specific approach so far when it comes to data protection, and they've done that in order to try to balance innovation and competition with privacy. Our privacy laws, way back when, anyhow, haven't been extremely clear. The Fourth Amendment the U.S. is usually pointed to as the main constitutional provision for data privacy and the reasonable expectation of privacy going back years and years. And then we have the Fair Information Privacy Principles, the FIPS, which came out in the 70s. So we have a long history of privacy in the U.S., Fair Credit Reporting Act in the 70s and so forth, and many, many sector-specific laws that have come after that. But we have not adopted a national privacy law. And now, you know, there's great debate since the GDPR took effect as to whether that approach needs to change. It's reactivated the discussion on the federal level and encouraged a multitude of state laws. Some have been enacted and some are pending, but every state in the U.S. in the last 5 years or so has enacted new privacy laws. Quite a bit going on in the U.S. Apart from codes of conduct, but that's certainly a part of it as well. And in my personal opinion, a code of conduct would may be helpful, but would be insufficient to regulate privacy on a national level in the U.S.
Yeah, thank you, John. You actually was involved in one of the most interesting projects of passing the ethical or philosophical approach to privacy to the practice, which is the privacy by design. Privacy by design, of course, formulated somehow by Anne Kavakian in Ontario, but you played the role of the ambassador of privacy by design. You know also that GDPR tried to implement it into the legal act, which is binding for everybody in the European Union. And could you tell us, do you find this this experience with privacy by design as an important and practical solution for those who started with the ethical dimension and try to go to the practical solutions? Or you rather think that it has to be at some stage turned into the law? Because there are many people in Europe who say, well, it's nice that these words appear in GDPR, but what they actually mean?
I personally think privacy by design is an excellent concept, and logically it makes sense as well. So I've been using it to build privacy frameworks basically since I started in privacy many, many years ago in the 2000s. As you mentioned, I was a global privacy officer at the early part of my career in privacy, and used privacy by design to build the framework for the company that I was with at the time, the pharmaceutical company, and also got to know Anne Kavakian well. And one of the principles that she talked about extensively and wrote about in her books is that privacy can be used as a competitive advantage. And we talked a little bit earlier about that concept. And to me, that's critical as well, and plays a role in privacy by design, because when companies realize the value of privacy and see it as a business driver rather than a cost, it becomes part of the corporate culture, and people are willing to embrace it and do so readily and favorably, instead of looking at it as, oh, this is something that we have to do, like fill out our timesheets or pay our taxes. And so when you build that concept into privacy by design and weave privacy into the processes and the new projects and the training and policies and procedures of the organization, I think you benefit greatly, in part by a public perception, because I think people, especially these days with everything on Twitter and everything on the internet and every comment that you make being evaluated by everyone in the public eye, or at least on social media, people can see right through crap or, you know, quote, bullshit these days. And so companies that are not actually embracing privacy and merely creating window dressing ultimately will be held accountable, either by breaches or by public perception or loss of customers, loss of patients. So I think privacy by design is critical, because you're actually building that infrastructure in the organization, and not just talking about it.
Okay, we start to get the first questions from the audience. There was a question on the novel ideas that are coming from the students and from the young people. So I will try to make it a little bit more general, and I would ask I would like to ask you, what do you see as the most important new ideas that are coming into the discussion in the field of ethics and the digital world? What, in your opinion, will be the new topics that we have not discussed yet? Is there anybody from the speakers who wants to approach that?
Well, Peter Shah, hello.
Yes.
May I step in? Well, we have discussed a lot of topics, but our regulations are limited to very specific issues. And the main question from my side is, where we have to go beyond those very specific issues that are already regulated. We have, if you look at the GDPR, we have information requirements. We have the right not to be a subject of a solely automated decision-making procedure. These are some starting points, there are also other issues related to new techniques. The question, which data should be used for gathering new information by neuronal networks? All the big data debate is related to the secondary use of data that is originally, in many cases, personal data. But it should not be personalized when it is used for gathering intelligence, artificial intelligence. But that's not the end. The next question is how to use the new information, the intelligence, for decision making. And who has the right to decide? Should the machine itself make the decisions? That would be a problem if you look at the requirement of the GDPR saying there should not be automated decision making. And I think we have to focus on these points. What should be the input? Are there some requirements how to define which data can be used for information gathering, for automated learning procedures? And the second is what should be done with the data, with the information that is won by these procedures?
Okay, so I'm opening the floor right now to the discussion between the speakers. If you want to address the points which were raised by the other speaker during this first part of the debate, and then we will go to the further questions also from those that are delivered by the audience. So do you want to comment on what the others said?
This is Julia. I had a question to Joan. I think it's that example is what we always hear, that there will be consequences for non-compliance and lost customers and other penalties. But I wondered, when you, in sort of speaking to industry, what sort of examples are used and what have helped shape future behaviour around past or recent past privacy breaches?
I have a lot of examples from my own work with companies, which I use, but then there are also plenty in the media. So when you look at building a privacy framework for a company, it can be expensive, and the company has to realize they have a limited budget and so forth and figure out what they need to do. And I think sometimes it's overwhelming because we have so many other areas of law in the U.S. and around the world that have to be complied with as well. And companies often see this as an expense. And they think, well, how will it really help us? But these days, versus in the past. When I started in privacy, it's easier to sell that point because of all the breaches that have been announced and all the enforcement and the public backlash. So now there's plenty of good data out there showing that healthcare organizations, once they lose a patient, the patient is gone for good. And obviously there's a lot of competition out there as well. So in the past, it was harder to show that data and that impact. And now we see an impact on stock price right away when there's a major breach that can linger for a long time, not only on stock price, but sometimes the SEC now is getting involved, Securities and Exchange Commission, or you see lawsuits by shareholders as well. So there, you can actually show the cost associated with bad privacy to organizations. And on the opposite side, you can also show them the benefit. So the benefit to customers, the ease of dealing with vendors when you have the right program in place and the right materials and so forth, you know, it makes the contracting process go a lot faster. And in the clinical research context, you normally have to get the patent up front for a new drug or potential compound, you know, a medical device. And so you're losing valuable days of patent life for the delay. And the delay to study startup can be a tremendous cost to the pharma industry, given the cost of research overall. So when you can speed up these processes by having good privacy in place, it saves money for the company, builds the reputation, and streamlines, you know, removes non-value-added tasks. Simply like another example is certifying to the Privacy Shield. You can eliminate a lot of extra non-value-added internal work by having that platform in place. So I think there's a lot of good data out there these days to use to show companies. Not all of them believe it, and you know, not all the data is credible, of course, either. But it's much easier to make that argument and show than it was years ago.
Yeah, Pernille, yeah, I also have a question. Is that okay for you, Joan?
Absolutely.
I totally agree on the fact that code of conduct and self-regulation is not enough. We really, really need the law as a basis. But what I'm also seeing, unfortunately enough, a lot in the US is kind of what you could call ethics washing. And that's, for example, I have to mention Facebook, for example, at the big conference we had in September in Brussels, they had a side event called Ethics and Privacy by Design. And I find it very, very hard to call Facebook Ethics and Privacy by Design. So how do you actually work with that when you see companies already now seeing this is so smart? Of course, you have to do that to work with trust.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, in the past, companies could get away with this a lot more. I agree with you that it's difficult for Facebook to be, you know, sponsoring something called Ethics and Privacy by Design. You know, on some level, they have some good intentions. They have to comply with the law, of course, and they're going to be facing a lot, it looks like, in terms of fines and accountability now and changing their practices. But I think in the past, companies could get away with that a lot more. And I love the term you use, the ethics washing. I think it was all about perception. It still is in some ways that if individuals associated a company with good ethical practices, you know, then there was a good public perception and people would buy their products and, you know, go to their websites and so forth. And all of that can quickly come crashing down if there's a big security breach or a big enforcement action, or someone discloses something about the company that many of us find astonishing and completely unacceptable. And in terms of Facebook, you probably heard that in the last week or so, a group of researchers filed a complaint with the FTC claiming that individuals who join specific health groups, such as women who have the BCRA genetic mutation for breast cancer, that their data could be downloaded in bulk and used for other purposes. And these women who joined this group didn't even know that Facebook was using their data for other purposes. In fact, it had at least reportedly been told to them that their data was confidential and not being used. So I think that a lot of these walls are coming down, and these organizations will ultimately be held accountable and not, you know, not be able to make these seemingly false representations to the public on a go-forward basis.
Well, I think it also addressed one of the questions which was asked by Filippo, one of the persons who is listening to the conversation, about the interplay between the compliance and the ethics. But there is another question from him whom I would want to pass also to all the participants. There's the one about how shall we then set the common ethical value chart, and for instance, for regulating the self-driving cars. But I understand it also as a question about the common ethical value chart for the whole global world, because the self-driving cars will be the very good example of the devices that are produced both in Europe, in the States, and in the Far East, and in probably in South America. So all these different cultures of ethics will be playing at the same time. Can we create some ethical value chart for everybody?
Pernille, yeah, just one short one. I would say it's an illusion to think so in the beginning. I mean, look at China, which you could call a data dictatorship, and Europe. I believe we could do it in Europe. And then maybe we could set the examples and get on the US in the long run, and India, and then we'd have to work really, really hard on China. But we have different values, so it would destroy everything if we try to have to do it from the beginning.
Let me be a little bit provoking. Does it mean that our values, the ones that we create in Europe, are those to be the first observed, or maybe there should be a kind of debate between these value charts that are created in different cultures? Well, somebody can say, well, even the old Chinese approach that if you are too private, then you are antisocial, is the legitimate approach, and this is also the ethics that exists in the world. So what kind of ethics then we then should use?
May I step in? Peter Starr. Well, there are some approaches to write such a charter, universal charter for ethical behavior. Look at the universal guidelines for artificial intelligence presented at the International Data Protection Conference in Brussels last year. This was written by NGOs, non-governmental organizations and scientists. Most of them are from the US. And I think this is a very good starting point for the debate which principles should govern artificial intelligence systems. This is only one part of the whole picture, but it's a very big part. At first, artificial intelligence is a core question, how to deal with those systems. Automated cars are dealing with artificial intelligence. Medical systems in the future will use artificial intelligence more and more, and even in other situations, decisions on credit delivering to individuals. This is also, these are, for all these decisions, artificial intelligence systems are used, and the universal guidelines are a valuable approach to start. Of course, not all over the world we share those values. In Europe, we discuss currently whether the values of the Islamic world are compatible with our understanding of fundamental rights. But nevertheless, there are some good approaches, and we should follow them, and we should build on them.
Okay, thank you for this intervention. Yeah, I will just add the very practical thing that Peter was talking about, guidelines on artificial intelligence, which were created by the Civil Rights Coalition Public Voice in October. And right now, there are 60 organizations and 260 individuals who endorsed it.
Hi, Cassandra. Can I just speak on the point? Because I think it's a crucial point and one that gets overlooked a lot. Is that I very much agree. I think it's an illusion to think that we're gonna come up with ethical principles that are are applicable around the world in different cultures and will stand the test of time. And there are those principles are also applicable to all sectors at the same time. So first, we have never in history ever agreed on something like that. And I think it's such an interesting thing to think that just because we have a new trending technology now that all of a sudden we're going to find those consensus. I think that's not how human nature works. And we had experiences in the past, if you look at human rights frameworks, for example, or what the UN has been doing, there have been struggles. And very often the principles there are very vague and not well defined because you have to find a compromise because of those cultural differences. So I see a worry that if we have principles, but we don't have any definition of what they mean and how to implement them in practice and how to hold people accountable if they're not acting according to those principles, then it's ethics washing, in my opinion. Then it's exactly that thing, the rubber stamping thing that we do. And I think it's important to keep in mind that I think we think that ethics is somehow binary and computable, and there is a one single answer to that question. And I think it's important to keep in mind that ethics is not supposed to be easy. Ethics is not there to be convenient. Ethics is there to challenge your views and your notions and convictions on a daily basis and to make sure that what you're doing is in accordance with what's necessary under current day conditions. So I think to keep that in mind, ethics is something that should guide you through your whole life and nothing that is static. And it needs to be agile because we as a society are constantly changing. And actually, it's something that we should embrace because that's something that is good and not just to, dumb it down into a box-ticking exercise. And I think that's when ethics can be powerful.
I have one more question to Julia, actually, and I know that Julia also wanted to intervene a little bit earlier, so probably we can follow up with it as well. Julia, could you tell us what is your opinion on the increasing role of the private sector, that the companies are taking over and they are going to talk about ethics instead of compliance? We have more and more big players who are creating the ethics board or privacy boards, even the external ones. I had an opportunity to take part in the meeting of one of the boards like that yesterday, of one of the big telecom companies, and it's a wonderful experience. But on the other hand, does it mean that there is a tendency to show that ethics is something instead of the compliance?
Thanks. Well, I'll make it quite concrete because I think we've had the conversation at some altitude here, and actually it goes to it was really helpful to have those examples from Joan because I think that experience of the pharmaceutical industry, which is very much, if you just think of the examples in the media and in compliance situations where pharma companies are involved and compare it to the likes of Google and Facebook, we face entirely different worlds in terms of consequence, public attitude, and so on. And so I think one of the challenges is that you have the likes of Google and Facebook, and I'll be specific about them, that really want to forward themselves as being very transparent and public-oriented. And in, say, the health context, I've looked at a subsidiary of Google, DeepMind, and its work in the health sector. And despite a national data protection authority in Europe finding that it had breached the Data Protection Act in four major respects, and that hadn't been redressed, the consequence was that they were allowed to, in that particular case, continue to process the data of nearly 2 million Londoners. Fully identified information in order to develop an app for a few of those people. And so we have these sorts of situations. We have one this week where Sidewalk Labs in Toronto has been very eager to pronounce that it's very ethical and it has all sorts of ethical boards, both these companies, DeepMind and Sidewalk, do. And yet it was able to talk about a project as if it was all about a 12-acre plot of land in the city of Toronto and that they would have strict controls on the use of information in that land. And then it became revealed in the media that it was in fact 300 acres and that their proposal is that there is going to be no de-identification. And they had the former Ontario Privacy Commissioner and the grandmother of Privacy by Design publicly denounce everything that they've done, leave their ethical board, and yet they continue without any consequence. So I think it's really important to be clear-eyed about these sort of examples. They've had a lot of media scrutiny. The examples in both London and Canada have very active and highly technically competent public civic activists and so on, and yet it seems that there is an absolutely unstoppable trajectory to the increasing, really untouched by law activities of these big companies.
Thank you for this example with Ontario and with Sidewalk. Of course, that was one of the points that I wanted to raise myself, because this moment when Anne Kavakian decided to step out from the ethical committee seemed to be the big change for all the observers, but actually nothing happened in the project itself, and the project is continued as it was in the past. So that's an important point. Are the ethical committees the way to fight with compliance, or they are simply the artificial entities created in order to make the PR better of the companies? But of course, on the other hand, we have very good examples from the business sector, from the business of implementing the real ethical approach to the processing of the personal data. I'm afraid that we will have to finalize the discussion more or less. I would like to ask all the participants to take the short stand or the short position at the end of the discussion. And at the same time, I would like already to ask you to save the date for the next discussion that we are going to deal with, that will be about the employment issues and the future of workplace and the ethical issues connected with the digital technologies that are employed there. That will be on 13th of April. So can I then ask you to summarize this short introductory the discussion that we had today? Well, once again, maybe starting with Peter.
Well, I think we have touched a lot of very important questions we haven't discussed enough because we have a limited amount of time. But I would say we have to take seriously the question of the practices of companies, but we have to take their word, the companies at their word. If they say we stick on ethics, we have to question what ethics, what are the criteria. We have to ask them to break down principles and announcements into operational criteria. And last but not least, ethics committees cannot replace clear rules and laws.
Thank you very much. Now I would like to turn to Pernille. Can you please once again summarize what are your points out of this short discussion?
Well, I believe that, of course, the law is the fundamental basics. That's what we need to comply with. And then we can talk about ethics. And because we have the best laws in Europe, I believe, maybe Canada has some good laws and some other countries as well, but we have the best privacy laws in Europe. And if we manage to comply with, to enforce those laws, I believe that actually European companies will have the best position to use data ethics as a competitive advantage, because it would be much easier for them to go a step further than complying with the laws and do something extra and listen to their customers For example, not using third-party cookies, which more and more people are really worried and annoyed about. So I think that European companies will have a special competitive advantage in the future.
John, you are the representative of those who are working on an everyday basis with the representatives of the business. What do you want to say as the summary of this discussion?
Well, I certainly agree with the points made by all of my colleagues. And I'd just like to add from the business perspective that I hear many, many times businesses say, we've always done it this way. And I think that's a very outdated approach and one that is not in the company's best interest any longer, especially with all of the changes going on in technology and the way that data is collected and used. I think companies need to embrace change and realize that the ways that worked in the past are not necessarily compatible with those in the future, and that they will be held accountable if they're not collecting and processing the data the way the public expects them to these days.
Thank you, John. You probably don't know about it, but when you enter the ICO office, the British Commissioner for Privacy office in Winslow next to Manchester, one of the sentences that you will see written down with the big letters on the wall was that the worst sentence in our language is "we always did it like that." So this is one of the mottos, actually, for those who are dealing with the new ways of dealing with the technologies. Can I ask Sandra to summarize as well?
Yeah, so I think I'm very excited about big data analytics and AI in general. But I think it's crucial that we now think about creative ways to guard against the novel risks. I'm a huge fan of GDPR, and I think it's a fantastic framework, and it shows Europe's leadership in data protection, and it will become a global standard, and it's a fantastic step forward. My worry is that we focus too much on things that are not good enough to guard against certain risk anymore. I think two things come to mind immediately when you think about data analytics and AI. One has to do with inferences and profiling and, you know, figuring out very intimate things about people and categorizing people in a certain way. And the second has to do with using that information to make very important decisions about people. So every time you go on a platform, you leave a data trail behind that is then being analyzed in ways that we cannot foresee and cannot comprehend. And we have very little control over that. So examples ranging from, I don't know, Facebook being able to infer political stances with Cambridge Analytica, or if it's about inferring sexual orientation, race, gender, whatever, all those things which are very, very sensitive. And that's something that is not quite governed in GDPR at the moment, because it very much just focuses on the input stage. It makes sure that we have consent, for example. It makes sure that the data is being accessed lawfully, data protection by design, and all of that. But it's very much about the input stage when you collect the data, and leaves, you know, a lot of room when the actual threat or potential risk is going to happen, which is after data collection, when you actually start using it. This is when you have an analytics. This is when you share it with other people. This is when it's being used for automated decision making, for example. So I think we need to, in addition to what we have already, think about rights to reasonable inferences, figure out what is a reasonable, responsible use of data analytics. And when it's then being used for automated decision making, then we have to make sure that those decisions are accurate, fair, and explainable, and give people an accountability mechanism. I see a very strong trend moving away from individual level rights to just codes of conduct. And especially in Europe, we have a very strong tradition of individual level rights. We give people the autonomy and the agency to be the master of their rights, to be the master of their data. And I think that's very valuable. And that's something we need to keep in mind. We cannot just rely on the ethical conscience of companies you need to have an accountability mechanism that ensures that your data is being used in a way that you agree with, you personally agree with. You should be in charge and decide what's happening with your data and how it's being used.
Thank you very much. And finally, Julia, could you please also say us what is your what are the things that you want to take out of this discussion?
Great, thanks. So first, I would give a wholehearted support to everything Sandra just said. I am in complete agreement. I would end with two challenges. The first is to those who would promote ethics, particularly industry. First, show us your ethicists. It's extraordinary how many people are willing to enter into the terrain of ethics who haven't had any training in ethics. It's a rigorous discipline, and I think that it would benefit those who stand with ethics to actually work with people who have experience with it. And the second is show us something you haven't done, or many things you haven't done because of ethics. Because I think until ethics actually is being implemented in a way that shapes behaviour, I think at the moment it's just giving a free pass. And then the second challenge is to the public sector, to regulators, to institutions who are discussing ethics. And I think that it's in many cases a distraction from two really important challenges that only democratically legitimate institutions can ask. And the first is show us your data to companies that are hoarding data on citizens to increasingly encroach on every aspect of their lives. And in addition to show us your data, show us your algorithms and how they work. Because I think that we need to be brave enough to ask that question that we ask in every other industry, and that is absolutely crucial to our futures. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I also understand it as a call to the organizers, meaning to the European Data Protection Supervisor. We are also the ones who should show that what ethics means for us in our activities. And we should also not forget that, first of all, we are the supervisors, we are the regulators. So we are the ones to ask for the data, show us your data, and also show us your algorithm. And if we discuss about ethics, this is creating the bigger background for the normal activities that the public institution should have. So thank you all for participation today. Thank you to all the people in the audience who are listening to us. The podcast will be available on the website of EDPS. And well, save the date for the next one, which, as I said, will be on the 30th of April. Thank you to Barbara, who was helping me to prepare this. Actually, she did all the job organizing the event. And thank you also to Christian D'Acuna, who is not with us today, because he's discussing very, very similar subjects at the Leuven University just at the same time. Thank you very much, and have a nice day.